Hey there, Super Sober Heroes. It's your host, Sober Steve, the podcast guy. And before we jump into today's episode, I want to take a brief moment to ask for your help to shape the future of gay A. Over the years, this podcast has grown and evolved as I've grown in my sobriety. And recently, I've been investing wild amounts of time, money, and energy to find ways to level up this podcast so it can get heard by the people who need to hear it. I want to take a brief moment to check in with all of you, though, to see what you love about the current show and what could be better as I'm growing and moving forward. In the show notes is a 3 to 5 minute survey for you to complete. I kindly ask that you pause this episode and take the time to complete it if you haven't already. You are kind enough to give me 20 to 40 minutes of your time each week when you listen to these episodes, and I want to make sure it's time well spent. So please let your voice be heard. Thanks, SoberPod, and enjoy the show. Hi, everyone, and welcome to Gay A, a podcast about sobriety for the LGBT plus community and our allies. I'm your host, Steve Bennett Martin. I am an alcoholic, and I am grateful for my career where I get to help seniors. As of this recording, I am 330 days sober, and today we're welcoming a guest to share their experience, wisdom, and hope with you. Welcome to the show, Scott.
Why, thank you, Steve. I'm delighted to be here. Scott G., recovering alcoholic, here with you today, and all the way from Queensland, in it's a state in Australia on the East Coast.
So wow.
Very far away from where I got sober in Boston, but that's part of the sobriety journey.
Excellent. Well, then to get started, why don't you tell us about what your sobriety journey was like?
Yeah, well, absolutely. And please feel free to flash, you know, time card signs at me.
Okay.
So look, I guess just for anybody listening, I just want to, you know, I used to work in marketing as my first career. And we always had to run everything past the legal department. So the legal department, you know, for AA, I am not a spokesperson for AA. I'm just a garden variety drunk. So for anybody listening, I don't represent AA or any, AA has no opinions on everything. I have lots of them, so it's okay to disagree with me and it's okay to not like me. And please don't hold it against any of the 12-step fellowships. I'm just this idiot sharing, to the best of my knowledge, you know, and ability, my experience, strength, and hope. So look, I grew up in Western Massachusetts on the East Coast on the States, really, and a super gay kid. So for any, you know, this idea for anybody who's listening, who lives, you know, a queer lifestyle in any of its permutations, I was, you know, the super queerest kid in the 1970s, in a very affluent town where a lot of the leading families trace their lineage back to the Mayflowers, that kind of uptight Protestant shit going down. And I was Catholic and I was Italian, so that was bad. My surname ended with a vowel. You know, everyone was like, you know, had three hyphenated names, Smith, Decanter, Jones, that kind of stuff. And I wore bright green flare trousers when all the other boys wore blue jeans, you know, like I wore pink shirts. I was really, really out there. And part of my recovery journey has been going back and spending time with that kid and saying, you were so fierce. Like you were fierce than when that word didn't exist. But I got my ass whooped, like for all through school, I was bullied and terrorized. And I had to seek outside help for that, because what it did was it made me feel unsafe and not felt unsafe. Like I was unsafe. People would walk down the hallway and be like, I'm going to beat you up after school. Yeah. And I had this, and you may be too young, in the Wizard of Oz, Miss Gulch, who's becomes the Wicked Witch of the West, has an old bicycle, an upright bicycle that she rides. And I had one of those in powder blue and it had chrome fenders. And I used to put colorful things in the spokes. I was so gay. I was like, satellites could see me from space. I was so gay. But I had a chrome headlight that I was particularly obsessed with. And so somebody would say they're going to beat me up, and I'd have to gather my books by like 2:14 and 2:15 when the alarm went off. I'd run to my Miss Gulch bike, and pedal my ass off school grounds. And that fucks with you. You know, like that's trauma. I didn't know the word trauma existed until I got sober, but that was traumatic. And I come from a long line of alcoholics. Half of my family is Italian, and to the best of my knowledge, there's no alcoholism there. There's French Canadian in my family. There's no alcoholism there. I have some Native American ancestry. That's a problem, because Native Americans, there's a belief that they can't metabolize alcohol. And I have one great grandparent who's Irish, Fitzgerald. And all of the alcoholics come falling out of the closet over the centuries through the Fitzgerald line. So I believe very passionately that alcoholism is a disease and it's inherited genetically. My mom and her sisters are affected badly by the diseases of alcoholism and addiction. My grandmother, my mother's mother, died at 59 from this disease. So it's deadly and it's killed a lot of members in my family, basically. So that's just the next in line. So I think that, you know, there's always one of your questions was, you know, what effect did my sexuality have on it? So absolutely, it was part of feeling different. But alcoholics, we know, feel different anyway. So I felt different times 20. And the trauma absolutely contributed to my need to escape in whatever way that was. So when alcohol came along, I was the last of my friends to drink because I saw how stupid they were. But and this is a sign of alcoholism. Alcoholics remember their first drink, right? So ordinary drinkers do not, right? So I remember it was a Miller High Life beer and I hated the taste, but my friends were all drinking and I drank it with one of my friends gave me a straw. So I drank a Miller High Life beer out of a straw and he said, drink it quickly. And I drank it quickly and hated the taste, but really liked the effect, really liked it. And for a queer kid who felt on the outside of society, alcohol never made me feel like I fit in, but it made me feel like I didn't care that I didn't fit in, if that made sense. It was just a relief. It was just a period of relief. And I'll tell you that I would still be drinking, Steve, if it still worked, if I got that relief, but alcohol stopped working relatively quickly. You know, I had my first drink at maybe 15 and a half, and I was in AA at 29. Like Dunsky, like cooked, fried, you know? So I believe that I'm addicted to alcohol. It triggers a compulsion in me and an obsession. I would, when I wasn't drinking I'm a Virgo. My star sign is a Virgo and Virgos are very organized. We're the very organized and we're right about everything. It's just annoying. Virgos are annoying to know and let alone be in a relationship with. But I used to organize like who I was going to drink with when. And this was in my mid-20s. This is how bad I was as an alcoholic. He saw me drunk last week. He can't see me. So I was organizing where I was going and who I was going with and who had seen me and which liquor store I had been in too often. And that's a lot of work. It's a lot of work. And as a blackout drinker, by my mid-20s, I would take drinks and then wake up. I'd take a drink in Boston and wake up in New Hampshire. No idea how I got over state lines. And, you know, once I was quasi-kidnapped, you know, in a blackout and woke up in a totally different town from where I'd been drinking and no idea where I was. And I thought that drama was living. I thought that was, wow, look at me being out there. I'm a suburban boy. Look at me in New Hampshire, waking up in a, you know, in a woodpile. One of my friends, when I got sober, told me that he saved my life because on a ski trip in New Hampshire, I went outside and passed out face down in a snow pile. And if they hadn't found me, I could have died of hypothermia. So that was just, that's how I drank. I drank like a pig. And people say, what's your drug of choice? My drug of choice, more. And back when I was drinking in the 80s and 90s, I had a real thing about drugs. Drugs are for dirty people. I was from the nice suburbs until I got drunk. And then you offered me something for free, right? And then it was like, sure. And then I judge you, right? I wouldn't pay for it. I'd smoke your pot. I'd do your coke. I'd never pay you for it. And then I'd scorn you the next day for your drug addiction problem. So, you know, just a smug bastard I was. And look, the bottom line is I got into dangerous situations with dangerous people. I ended up dating a bartender in a gay bar because I figured out, this is a very good strategy, by the way. If you are having sex with a bartender, you never have to wait for drinks. Anybody who's still drinking, if you want to get out there, like date the bartender. So Trey's used to come around and never had to wait. Because part of my alcoholism was once I started drinking, I had to feed the monster and there was no waiting in lines, right? So that was the scariest thing. I didn't go out on New Year's. I'm an alcoholic. I didn't go out on New Year's because it was amateur night and you had to wait. It was fuck being social. It was about, I had to feed the disease. So two things happened when I was 29. One was I was dating a super hot Frenchman. He was an interior designer. He met me at the gym and he was like 16 leagues out of my dating. Like it was just, I don't know where he came from. And his name is Ned. And he was sober 3 years. And I went to his house one night for dinner and I brought a six pack with me. And Ned opened the door and he looked at me in horror and said, "Scott, remember I told you I'm a recovering alcoholic?" And my response was, "Yeah, I know. That's why I only brought one six pack." Right? That's how inconsiderate and selfish and self-seeking I was. That was just for me. I brought what I needed on this date with this hot Frenchman. And he broke up with me. We didn't date very long, but he said something that was super important to me. He said, "You're dangerous to my recovery." And it was the first time I'd ever heard. I knew my drinking was dangerous for me, but I couldn't stop. I heard that it was a problem for someone else. So that was the first signpost. And the second was my best friend growing up had a beautiful partner named Tim. And Tim got sober. And we used to drink together and take drugs together. And all of a sudden, Tim was bright and shiny on Sunday mornings. And he wasn't spending his rent money, you know, at whatever it was, Club Cafe, I think it was in Boston at that time. I don't even know if it's still around. But he got, and I watched the quality of light change in his eyes. And he looked shiny and happy. And I had crippling hangovers. And often tell the story about how my closet in my little apartment in the south end of Boston had louvered doors on it, you know, for air circulation. And my bed was close to the closet doors. And I was particularly allergic to red wine. And I would projectile vomit red wine from my bed into my closet. I would vomit through the louvers and it would end up all over my work clothes and all of my. So I'd open up the next morning, there'd be stripes of red wine and vomit on my clothing. That's the kind of messy drinker I was. And I got sick and tired of being sick and tired. You know, this, and the epic moment for me was on Sunday. Usually I vomited a lot because I was so allergic to alcohol. And when I would go out for a night, I would put three extra Tylenol along my kitchen counter and three glasses of water before I went out. That's how much planning had to go into my alcoholism. And when I'd come home, hopefully I'd see some water and take the extra Tylenol. But at the end of my drinking, I decided that projectile vomiting from my bed was becoming a problem, not to mention wetting my bed. And I had friends that were shitting themselves, and I knew I was not interested in that narrative at all. So I took to sleeping in my bathroom on Sunday nights, and I had this really expensive Polo Ralph Lauren comforter. It was very important that you knew that it was Polo Ralph Lauren too, right? I was all about labels. I wore Brooks Brothers suits and I was very ripped and I did step aerobics. It was all about looking good on the outside and having a God-sized hole on the inside. And so I was sleeping. I used to sleep sideways on the toilet. And my rationale was if I vomited, at least some of it would get in the toilet. And the rest of it, the linoleum came up around the sides in the bathroom. So that it created like a natural catchment for the rest of the vomit. And I thought that was completely normal, sleeping on your toilet wrapped in your Polo Ralph Lauren comforter. I thought that was perfectly fine strategy. Well, on this particular Sunday morning, I think it was something like December 1st, 1992, I had an out-of-body experience. I saw myself. I woke up on the toilet and I was floating above myself. And I saw... And the only word is depravity. I saw the depravity of my life. I saw that it wasn't normal. And I believe, and I was a very angry agnostic for my first 10 years in recovery. And I fought the words G-O-D and higher power. But I had a moment. This was a total moment of clarity that was not for me. So whatever we ascribe that to, I now talk about having a goddess of my misunderstanding. But I saw that and I cried out. And this is... I find this in most people's recovery. There's a moment of truth. And whether they literally cry out, I'm quite dramatic, right? So I always go for a Jean-Paul Sartre moment. But I cried out and said, "Dear God, if you're out there, help me or kill me." And I came to some hours later in a meeting of AA. And right, and my first year, like this year, different year, like everything was happening. And I was going, "Oh, that's mysterious." Like I would, you know, I was just like, how's that? You know, so I came to a meeting of AA in Boston, and it was in the High Holy Catholic Cathedral of Boston in the South End. And I was not very happy with the Archbishop and the Cardinal at that time. They were saying some awful things. And I knew this was so much of my recovery is about ego deflation at depth. And I think my ego needs deflating. So my first meeting was in the High Holy Catholic Cathedral, and I was an angry agnostic, recovering Catholic, you could say. It was in the basement of this church, and it was next to the crypt where the dead priests were buried. That was my first meeting of AA. And I thought, oh, honey, you've really arrived. Like, oh, you've like home run type, you know, great work. But I saw men, it was a gay meeting, gay men who were clean and sober, like clean, like physically and happy. And what I got in my first meeting was hope. And they said to me, keep coming back. And they surrounded me and they gave me their phone numbers, which I thought meant they wanted to have sex with me. So I was like, you know, and I scorned and judged them. I'm like, you're too fat. You wear inappropriate clothing. You're wearing polyester. I was like, you know, reasons that I wasn't going to be part of this group, but I kept coming. I went to, and I only went to a meeting a week for my first 4 months. Cause that's all I knew. I was so insane. I can't describe to you how insane I was at the end of my drinking. So I went to one meeting a week, didn't get a sponsor, didn't touch the literature, didn't have a service commitment. And after 4 months, I went to South Beach on holiday and I drank because that's what alcoholics do. And when I drank in South Beach, I was astonished because I'd been to AA, but I know the words. I know there are steps. I know I could parrot to you what it meant, but I got drunk. And one of those phone numbers that was in my wallet, and this is how long ago it was, 1993, I had to go to a payphone at News Cafe in South Beach, Miami. And I had to go to the bartender and get coins. I had to get quarters and put them in a payphone. Now, my nieces who are in their early 20s don't know the sound that quarters make when they go in a payphone. And, you know, they're astonished by the, you know, rotary dial kind of concept. But I rang this guy in Boston, which would have cost a buttload of money back then. And I got this guy, his name is Hebert. And I called him and I said, Hebert, I'm drunk and I don't know how this happened. And he said, I hope everyone has comedic sponsorship. He said to me, honey, did you put alcohol in your mouth? And I was like, oh, yes, I did. How did you know that? Oh my God, you're so wise. And he said something that I needed to hear in my first step. Honey, if you don't put alcohol in your mouth, you can't get drunk. And I thought, this is the wisest man I have ever met in my life, ever. And look, he became my sponsor. I went back to Boston and we began to work the steps. And I'm so grateful to that man because he didn't, I was so fucked. My step one is I'm fucked. My step two is I'm insane. And so if I'm fucked and insane, I better look for wisdom outside of myself, right? That's step three. I better look for GOD, group of drunks or great outdoors or good orderly direction. I've tried not to forget that. And my sobriety date is the 12th of May, 1993. And so that's 28 and a half years. And how could a drunk, a hopeless drunk like me stay sober? Well, remembering that I'm fucked and I'm insane. That's my resting state. And I know people listening to this might be really insulted by that, but I say that with great compassion for myself and others. It's just like, if you're fucked and you're insane, don't try to solve your alcohol problem by yourself, right? That's not going to go so good. Crazy plus crazy is going to equal crazy, right? So this man started taking me through the steps and he didn't say to me, step one, he didn't say, are you powerless over alcohol and is your life unmanageable by you? That would have been Mandarin to me. He said, honey, have you had enough? And that continues to serve me well whenever I'm struggling in recovery. I've struggled with credit card debt. I've struggled with sex behavior, with food. And my sponsor, I've had the same sponsor now for 24 years. And he just says, I'll be up to something, because I'm always up to something, by the way, even, yeah. And I'll call him and say, oh God, you know, I'm in the cookies again. You know, whatever it is. We have Tim Tams in Australia that are wonderful, but in whatever it is in America, Fig Newtons, Mallow Puffs, whatever you're, but you know, I'll find my face in, you know, an entire box of those and I'll call my sponsor and be like, I'm in the cookies again. And the journey to recovery starts with just, have you had enough? All right. He'll say, have you had enough of the compulsive spending? Have you had enough of the credit card debt? Have you had enough of the cookies? And when I say yes, then I can start to make progress in recovery. So for me, working the steps has been an entire new way of looking at life because I was so focused on outwardly. The last thing I wanted to do was look at my own shit, right? And we're in the fourth month of now and it's the fourth step. The fourth step changed my life. The fourth and fifth steps are the game fucking changes, right? So I realized I was fucked. I was insane. I was going to look for wisdom. So I got a sponsor, started working the steps. got a home group, got a service commitment. And in step four, I learned about the instincts. Like, so the most important, I think the most important thing of things I've learned are, I have a progressive fatal disease that's incurable. I can get a daily reprieve contingent on my maintenance of a spiritual condition, and to look at my fears and instincts, right? So my partner, Steve, and I just bought a beautiful 3-acre property in Australia. It's, he describes it as, we've bought an abandoned Boy Scout camp. It's in really rough shape. And so I'm, as a perfectionist Virgo suburban boy, I'm triggered as fuck because the gardens are messy and the houses are falling down. And I have to realize, you know, what I was taught in the four step are, I have instincts for security, self-esteem, personal relations, money, and sex. And whenever any of those instincts are triggered, I behave badly or I go into panic. And then, and I also have fears that I'm going to lose what I have, that I'm not going to get what I want, or both. And I learned that in the fourth step, that when I'm triggered, it's not about you, it's not about what you're doing, but it's about my instincts. So that moving into this house has affected my instincts for security. Like there were big gaps in the forest. We have 6-foot pythons that live in the forest where we are in Australia. You know, like we have big monitor lizards. We like all kinds of poisonous spiders, and there are gaps everywhere and doors and shit. So my instincts for security are triggered as fuck right now. And then, but when I realize that and call my sponsor and tell him, it dials back the anxiety, right? So in 4 and 5, I realized I'm riddled with character defects. All of my resentments, I have the character defects of pride and anger. Every single resentment, I'm the character defect. Pride is, I know how you should act. I know how the president should behave. I know the weather. I know. And nothing separates me from my goddess, from my spiritual self, and my fellows faster than me knowing what's best for you. Like, and I spent so many years minding your business. Oh my God. And I was full of helpful advice. But what AA taught me is that while I had lots of opinions, I had very little experience. Right. So I used to give my friends relationship advice. I'd never been in a relationship. Right. Like, so, you know, my sponsor started saying, do you have experience in this area? And I would say, no. And he'd say, okay, restraint of tongue and pen. Let's not give advice where we don't have experience. And when I got to be about 15 or probably more likely 20 years sober, it occurred to me that most people are not interested in my wisdom and my experience. And so nowadays, even with my sponsees, I've got 5 sponsees at the moment. I will, you know, they'll call me and they'll be talking about, I was going to say crapping on about something. That's really what I meant. I was going to, and I'll say, would you like my experience on this? Or are you just venting? And 99% of the time, they're like, no, I'm just venting. I'm not actually interested in your wisdom. I'm like, okay, saves me so many words. You know, I don't have to solve your problems today. So look, when I did my 4th and 5th step and finished it in Boston, my sponsor said to me, Scott, you're an alcoholic. You've got these resentments. You've got these character defects, pride, anger, lust, sloth, gluttony, greed. You know, he said, first of all, congratulations. You're a member of AA. You've done your 5th step. And he asked me a question. He said, what do you want your life to look like? And I was astonished by the question. And I was a frightened kid. I was never going to be more than 10 miles from my parents. My sister lived in Boston. I was never going to leave my friends. I had a great home group. And I thought about it for a minute. And I said to him, I want a great adventure. And my sponsor, who was probably 12 years sober at that point, almost fell off the chair because he knew what a frightened kid I was. And he said, be careful. The universe is listening. What do you choose for your life? And I was as astonished as he was. And I said, yeah, I want a big adventure. And be careful. Be careful when your higher power is there and you're listening. So my life took off. This frightened kid from Boston, when I was 4 years sober, I moved to San Francisco. One of my sponsees moved out there. And all he had to do was say to me, we don't shovel snow. That's all he said. I'm in San Francisco, great recovery. We don't shovel snow. Wham! You know, 4 years sober, I was in San Francisco. And I met a guy from New Zealand when I was living in San Francisco. And we were together for 9 years. And we moved to, he wanted to move home to New Zealand initially. And I was like, nah. I didn't even know where New Zealand was on the map, by the way. I had to look it up. I thought it was somewhere near Denmark. And we moved to Australia in 2000. And I've lived for 5 years, ended up living in New Zealand for 5 years. I've been in Australia on and off since 2000. So I've been out of the United States for the most part for 22 years. So how did a recovering alcoholic, a fall down queer drunk kid from Longmeadow, Massachusetts, end up in the hinterlands in a rainforest in Australia? Well, I asked for it. I asked for a big adventure and I kept doing the work. I continue to do the work in recovery. I have a service commitment. I have a home group. I continue to do the work and my life continues to grow and change in unbelievable ways. And the work for me today is in my 11th step, continuing to try to continue to improve my conscious connection with whatever the spirits of the universe are, which for me is love, right? Get out of fear and get into love. And to examine through daily meditation and prayer, where am I? Take my own temperature. I've taken your temperature for decades. I know you're flawed. I don't have as much experience in focusing on all my flaws. So keeping the focus on me and trying to be the most loving and kind person that I can be today is shaping up to be a very rewarding and busy life. So thank you for having the opportunity to share that story with you.
Yeah, it was a great story to listen to. And with that, I mean, out of all the positive changes in your life since finding sobriety, what's one or two that have surprised you the most?
As a gay kid, I had so much shame. You know, I was a sinner. I was going to hell. And my church confirmed that for me, by the way. Losing shame, having shame wash out like the tide by doing esteemable acts, by becoming a person that I was proud of. I was experiencing so much shame and then I'd go out drinking and shame myself. It was this repetitive cycle. So not having shame dominate my life has been, the relief from that has been completely game changing. I'm no longer ashamed of who and what I am. I can say I'm a recovering alcoholic without being embarrassed by that today. It's just like, oh yeah, I've got hazel eyes and I'm a recovering alcoholic. And somehow along the, you know, that shame going away, I can tell you now that I'm a gay man of dignity and worth. And I don't bow before anyone else in the way. Everything was like, hi, I'm Scott, I'm gay. Is that okay with you? And today it's just like, here I am. And it's okay for you not to like me. So just finding humility, as my sponsor talks to me about a lot, is the definition of it is it's an honest understanding of who and what we are, followed by an earnest desire to be all that we can be. And I think that's a beautiful roadmap. I know who I am today. I'm an alcoholic. I'm a gay man. I'm a member of society. And I'm pretty happy about that. So definitely the shame going away was a big thing. And the other thing was I got sober in gay meetings. And so for my first maybe 3 years, I was only going to gay meetings. So I thought only gay, LGBTIQ+. I only thought we had feelings and fears. And then I needed to start going to morning meetings at about 3 years sober because I was batshit crazy again and couldn't make it through a work day until the night meeting. So with my sponsor, I started going to a morning meeting in Boston and there were straight people there. And I was sitting next to these gigantic firemen and policemen and football players. And they were sitting next to me and they were talking about their alcoholism and they were talking about being afraid and being unsure and not knowing what to do. And it was just this wall came down like, straight guys are afraid too? You know, I had built this narrative that I'm the sissy Mary who's afraid of everything and everyone. And I'm the only one who's afraid. So going mixing more broadly in society, I've realized that I'm just a human being. I'm just another bozo on the bus, that my sexuality doesn't define me. You know, it's much more inclusive for me to think about my alcoholism because I can go into a meeting and I've been all over the world going into meetings. And it doesn't matter if you're a Buddhist monk or a sex worker. It's just like, hey, I know who you are. And that feeling of community blossoming around me has been probably the other super great gift.
Yeah, that's amazing. I definitely need to expand my meetings a little bit more. So that's a good kick in the butt for that. I needed to hear it. And you share on your Instagram page how you are an energy healer, psychic, and mentor. Can you share how those gifts have impacted your sobriety?
Well, I would say that they've come about entirely because of my recovery. So in doing in the third step, I acknowledged, you know, I acknowledged that I was insane and fucked totally. And I wouldn't get a higher power. And my sponsor, who busted me on everything, I could never get away with anything. He just said to me, "Well, Scott, let me ask you a question. Do you believe that I believe?" And I was like, "Yes, I do believe that you believe in something." And he said, "Great. Why don't you borrow my higher power?" And I was so busted that I couldn't debate him. I was like, "All right." And he said, "Get on your knees in the morning, get on your knees for 2 seconds and say, 'Please help.' And at the end of the day, get on your knees and say, 'Thank you.'" And I was like, "There is no fucking way." Because it was just triggered me in my religion of upbringing. Like, there's no way I'm getting on my knees. And he said to me, I'll never forget this. He said to me, "Oh, honey, you've been on your knees for far less than prayer." And I laughed and was like, "Touche, motherfucker." But I did it. And, you know, first day, my boyfriend wasn't around. I got on my knees and I was like, "Please help." And then ran. And at the end of the day, I got on my knees and I was like, "Thank you," and ran. And within a couple of weeks, I couldn't wait, right? So my spiritual, as I've practiced having a spiritual connection to whatever is out there, it's led me to be curious about lots of things. So I joined the Unitarian Universalist Church when I was about a year sober, and lots of recovering people and lots of people in the queer community were there. And that was amazing for me. We had a lesbian was our minister, and that was amazing coming from the religion I came from. And so I continued to get curious. And then I had friends, my sister had spiritual experiences in meditation, and she was doing astral travel. And one of our best mates became a shaman, and she started doing energy healing. And again, I always have to tell you, it's never about virtue with me. It's always competition or desperation that gets me to do work. But I wasn't going to let my little sister be more spiritual than me, was I? Right. So I followed her into meditation. I followed her into investigating shamanic practice. And I joined groups and I started getting training. And a teacher told me, "Hey, Scott, you've got intuitive abilities." And I didn't know that. I was 23 years sober. And I didn't know. He said, "You know those things you know about people? That's not normal." And I thought it was just being a good sponsor. I'd be hearing somebody's fifth step and I would tell them stuff about their life. And they'd be like, "How do you know that? I haven't told you that." And I'd be like, "Oh, it's just AA." And with some training, I was like, "Oh, it's a something. It's the thing." So look, being a psychic and a medium and an energy healer, it's just a skill. Like I'm a carpenter or an electrician. I just happen to have skills that I can read people's energy. I know what's going on for people and I can help them with that. So, but that's from practicing the 11th step, continuously, consciously, repetitively being curious about how I'm connected to the universe. And I still do. I work with the elderly. I do elder care. That's part of my career. And I work with people, great, wonderful people supporting them, people with disabilities. So I've left the corporate sector altogether and I'm loving these people, these elders. And when you come from where I come from, you know, I know surrendering my corporate life because it wasn't feeding my soul was very difficult. It was a death of ego that was very painful. And my partner had to support me in doing that because it was really hard. I had to get retraining. I make a fraction of what I used to make, but I'm so happy because I grew up on the East Coast thinking I can't do work that I enjoy. That's not an option for me. My Italian family, my grandmother used to say, "Life is a battaglia, Scotty Tomasi. You know, life is a battle. You're going to suffer and then you're going to die." You know, that's the wisdom from, you know, six generations of New Englanders. Pull your bootstraps up. If you sever your artery, you put a Band-Aid on it and you go to work, you know. And so all these years later, I'm doing work that I love with souls that I adore and doing healing work that I can't believe I get paid to do. But it took me far out 25 years to believe that I was worth doing, you know, having work that I enjoyed, that it was a possibility for me. So it's all from AA and the continuous work of step 11 and just dropping, you know, one of your questions is what are three, you know, what's the greatest thing I've learned is my sponsor gave me three statements that have changed my life. One is I give up. The second is I don't know. And the third is it's none of my business. Like that's like, my God, that's my spiritual program. I give up knowing. It's none of my business what you're doing in your life. It's none of my business, you know, what's going on in the world. I just have to be the best person I can be. And just if I keep the focus on me, if I keep tending my own garden, amazing things happen. You know, I keep saying this to you, but like I'm a drunk from Boston. I'm in Australia. I've been overseas for 20 years. Well, how did that happen? Like, how is that possible for a drunk who used to projectile vomit into his closet? That was my life. And look at it now. So hell yes, I'm incredibly grateful for recovery. And it's a journey that I can't outgrow. You know, I don't know if this is something the Americans say as much, but I have problems in areas where I didn't have areas before. Mm-hmm. Like I have home. I own a home. I have a beautiful partner. None of that was possible for me. You know, it's an extraordinary journey.
Yeah. And part of your journey and another thing we have in common is podcasting. Would you like to share a little bit more about your Fierce Conversations podcast?
Well, thank you. I had a girlfriend, part of the spiritual work. You know, I started meeting extraordinary souls who were curious like me. And my girlfriend started a spiritual magazine a couple years ago called Fierce Truths Magazine. And part of recovery for me is I used to say no to everything. Like there's a story my parents used to tell when I was first going to kindergarten. My parents sat me down. I was whatever, 4 or 5. You're going to go to kindergarten and you're going to make friends. It's going to be wonderful. And I said to them, no, thank you. You know, and my poor parents were very young when they had me. And they were like, what the fuck? What do you do with no thank you? That was my, I didn't want anything to do with life. I wanted to sit on the sidelines. I didn't want to play. And over time, that no thank you, which was my knee-jerk reaction to every opportunity, has become not no, right? That's 28 years of recovery. Is someone will post something to me, I'll be like, I'm not going to reject you right now. I'm going to go talk to my sponsor. So when I started working, supporting my friend in the magazine, it was, fuck it. Why not? And that's tremendous freedom. So I was her editor for 2 years, 18 months, maybe 18 months, editing spiritual articles. And we started doing podcasts and had great fun with it. And then it was time for me to move on. So I've moved on from that and thinking about my own podcast and thinking about what's next for me in terms of I'm trying to express my gratitude for 28 years of recovery and the profound changes. Like I'm a big talker, as you probably figured out, but like I'm so undone by the thousands and thousands of hours that I was going to say alcoholics, but human beings have spent with me throughout my recovery, guiding me and offering me helpful experience that how am I ever going to pay that back? How am I ever going to do that? You know, I've got my sponsees, but I go to regular meetings, but like, man, I got so much to be grateful for and so many thank yous to give that, you know, I think it's time that I step out on my own and I've been shit scared about that. That's why I'm so proud of you doing your own thing, you know, because that old gay, that gay kid on the playground with the flare covered pants, you know, stands next to me and goes, it's unsafe. It's unsafe to step out. Don't step out from your comfort zone. So, you know, for me, I've had to come out a number of times. I came out as gay at 26, came out as a recovering alcoholic at 30, came out as a psychic and medium at what, 55, age 55. And now it's, you know, coming out again as, you know, as somebody who wants to be more connected to my spirituality and more open publicly about that. So, you know, one of the things AA has taught me is I thought growing up that courage was the absence of fear. And AA has taught me that courage is real courage is being scared shitless and still taking the action, taking the healthy action, not stupid action, not step in front of a train action, but well-considered action with your sponsor's input, blah, blah, blah. And that to me is another gift, right? Being scared shitless. Like I recognize the scared gay kid says, don't put yourself out there. But it's in conflict with wanting to say thank you for the incredible life that I've been given and wanting to help other people have their best life. So yeah, so it continues to unfold.
Yeah. And I mean, you mentioned, you know, how you're helping other people. I mean, if you can give one piece of advice to someone who's sober curious or newly sober, what would that be?
If you think you have a problem with alcohol, you probably do. People who don't have a problem with alcohol rarely think about whether they have a problem with alcohol. You know, so I would say to somebody, I guess, alcoholism is a disease. It's nothing to be ashamed of. And I had so much shame. I was like, oh fuck, I'm a sissy Mary, and now I can't drink like a man. Oh god damn it, you know, and. You know, I talk about Phyllis. I have the voice of my addict I call Phyllis. She's a 70-year-old woman who lives in a dirty caravan in Scottsdale, Arizona, and she smokes unfiltered cool cigarettes and her hair is always in curlers. But that's Phyllis, you know, is, oh, I don't know, this is all hell. You suck, I suck, and it sucks. But there's no shame to being an alcoholic. If you have a progressive fate, my sister had double breast cancer. My sister did not have to work through toxic shame about cancer. She was like, it's cancer. So for somebody who's thinking about alcoholism, if you have a problem with alcohol, there's no shame in that. It just means you can't metabolize alcohol like other people. You know, my partner is allergic to strawberry jam, as an example. He doesn't spend years going, well, maybe it's not strawberry jam. Maybe it should be blueberry jam. I'll try blueberry jam. He had an allergic reaction to strawberry jam. He doesn't eat strawberries anymore. You know what I mean? So if you have an allergy, it's just like, think about that. Come give us a red hot go. And I used to think this was a cult. And I said to my first sponsor, oh, this is a cult. And he was like, well, interesting. It's a cult that you can come and go and you never have to come back here. And, you know, that's fine. And I said, oh, you want to get all my money? And he said, no, it's just a suggestion. You can contribute or not, but we're glad you're here. And I said to him, you know, I think you're trying to brainwash me. And he said, oh, honey, your brain could use a wash, you know, so just come here and check it out with an open mind. Look for the similarities. I'm always looking for the differences. He's tall. She's this, that, you know, and it's just like, come listen. Is there something here that resonates in your soul, in our messages about our disease and having found a way out? If something resonates with your heart, give yourself the gift of checking it out.
Yeah. And speaking of things resonating with your heart, in recovery, us addicts typically love our steps, traditions, and sayings. Do you have a favorite mantra or quote to live by?
I've spent time in Al-Anon and Debtors Anonymous too. So there's so much wisdom in all the affiliated 12-step programs. But I think the thing my sponsors told me, I give up, I don't know, and it's none of my business. That's the thing that saves my ass. And probably close behind that is when it says in the big book, practicing restraint of tongue and pen carries a top priority for us. Mm-hmm. Like keeping my mouth shut or not, don't send that text. Don't tell that person when you're triggered and your instincts for security, self-esteem, personal relations, pocketbook, and sex, when you're triggered, don't do anything. Pause and breathe, you know, that moment of grace, we call it in recovery, you know, between my reaction, my triggered reaction and my response, that golden moment of don't count to 10 has saved my life more times than I can tell you. So that's probably that I use that on a daily basis.
Yeah. Excellent. Thank you so much. And thank you so much for being on. Tell our listeners a little bit more about how they can find you if they want more Scott.
Well, contact me, you know, I'm in meetings. Hopefully, and we're all remaining anonymous with each other, but you can find me. I've got a website, Scott.Grasso, where you can talk about my services. I do stuff online as well as in person. And I'm on Insta, Scott T. Grasso. And so, yeah, and Facebook. So happy to connect with people and happy to support them in their recovery journey. So what a joy. Thank you. You know, what a joy seeing you. What a joy that you're excited. I'm excited that you're excited about your recovery. And yeah, I look forward to the dialogue continuing.
Yeah, excellent. Well, thank you so much again. And thank you, listeners, for listening to another episode of Gay A. Please rate and review if you found this information helpful. If you're interested in sharing your story like Scott here, getting involved with the show, or just saying hi, always love to hear from you. You can email me at gayapodcast@gmail.com or find me on Instagram at gayapodcast. And be sure to follow us wherever you're listening so you can get new episodes when they come out every Monday and Thursday. And until next time, stay sober, friends.